This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of June 30th, 2019. Welcome, and happy Canada Day and happy Independence Day. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, the Is It Just Me commentary. Headlines from the Pacific Rim and Pacific Northwest. The Big Deal feature. I speak with investigative journalist Diana Enriquez. She is the author of The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust. She was in Vancouver last week for the Trace International Bribery and Economic Crime Summit. And I will award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or should the 152nd birthday of Canada be a time when we consider whether the idea of Canada should even continue? No surprise, the answer is yes. The reason I ask this question is because of the dispute with China that even predates last December's arrest and bail of Huawei chief financial officer Meng Wanzhou and the retaliatory arrests of Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig. Some Canadians, including ex-Prime Minister John Chrétien and ex-Ambassador John McCallum, say that Canada should just free Meng and try to resume normal relations with China. I say, let our independent courts show what they're made of. Fair justice was one of the reasons why Canadians fought and died in two world wars. The Americans want to try Meng on charges of fraud, but for now she's living in luxury in Shaughnessy under a $10 million bail while she awaits a court hearing. The People's Republic of China, under Leader for Life Xi Jinping, is flexing its muscles and spending its money around the world as a weapon. Vancouver's closest major airport and seaport on this side of the Pacific. No doubt trade and tourism are good for both countries. Free trade sometimes is the precursor to other freedoms, but not in the case of China, which remains a dictatorship by the Communist Party, where lawyers and journalists are routinely jailed for just challenging authority and asking questions. China has spent considerable time and money through its United Front program to influence politicians in other countries. Canada has a federal election in just 16 weeks, and intelligence authorities warn that China could try to Canada what the Russians did to the U.S. during its 2016 elections. Not only the Meng Wanzhou dispute, but the banning of canola and meat exports from Canada and a show of force by Chinese fighter jets against a Canadian Navy ship in international waters, it just keeps happening. And this happens at a time when there are 250,000 Canadian passport holders in Hong Kong, where China is trying to erase the one country, two systems pledge made in the 1997 handover. Can't forget Taiwan, which is a democracy that China wants to annex. So, to honor those who helped build Canada, including many Chinese immigrants, immigrants from Hong Kong and Taiwan too, for the last 152 years, let's be proud on Canada Day and hope for another 152 years of the home and native land, true north, strong and free. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. Stephen Letts reports for ABC News Australia. Baoshan Bank collapse threatens China's economy and may trigger central bank response. The Inner Mongolia lender made a $600 million profit in 2017. It had assets of around $90 billion. Then it collapsed. For the first time since 1998, Chinese regulators seized the bank. This happens as the Chinese economy is slowing and under pressure from the ongoing battle with the U.S. over trade. Perhaps the most positive spin that can be put on the Baoshan collapse is, if it is a step to eroding the mountain of problematic debt in the Chinese financial system and tempering the cavalier approach to risky lending, it is a step in the right direction. In the Star Online, Dr. M confirms motion to compel MPs to declare assets will be tabled. Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad confirms the government will table a motion in Parliament to compel all MPs to declare their income and assets to the Malaysian Anti-Corruption Commission. He made that announcement at the opening of a Marvel Comic Books studio exhibit opening. He said that all MPs should declare their assets as each of them has influence over others. Sun Kok Lei reports in the South China Morning Post, Hong Kong July 1st handover ceremony scaled back amid extradition bill protest security concerns. The flag-raising ceremony to mark the anniversary of the 1997 handover from Britain to China will be reduced in size with fewer participants. The announcement came after 100 protesters arrived at the Hong Kong Justice Department demanding that the extradition bill be withdrawn. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines in the Pacific Northwest. Jim Brunner reports in the Seattle Times, Washington Governor Jay Inslee struggles to get speaking time in first Democratic presidential primary debate. Inslee seemed at times invisible, and only 7 minutes of the two-hour debate was on climate change, his key issue. And even on other topics, from guns to healthcare to immigration, Inslee was largely sidelined as moderators returned again and again to better-known candidates. Inslee, who was positioned near the right end of the stage, repeatedly raised his hand and pointed his index finger to try to get called on, only to be passed over. He estimated he would get 8 minutes, but ended up with only 5 minutes, the least of any candidate based on a New York Times count. Inslee called Donald Trump the biggest threat to national security. Amy Green reports in the Oregonian, misplaced decimal point means Oregon County's 911 system could be out millions. The Columbia 911 Communications District, the agency that fields emergency calls in the 52,000-person county, asked voters in May to approve an operations levy taxing property owners 0.29 cents per $1,000 of assessed property value. The agency meant to ask for 29 cents per $1,000. Nearly 74% of voters approved the levy at the lower rate, just a fraction of a penny. The mathematical blunder could mean the district might only be able to legally collect 87 cents per year from the owner of a typical $300,000 home, rather than the intended $87 per year from that same owner. Over the span of the five-year levy, the 911 district estimated it would collect $7.92 million at the higher rate. At the lower rate, it would collect less than $80,000 over those same 5 years. And last week in the Breaker.News, these headlines. Executive recounts the day police raided SNC-Lavalin headquarters. Vancouver Green says nothing nefarious about China's party for BC politicians, but Poco Mayor says it's wrong to cozy up to the human rights offender. And another foreign buyer tax bill court dispute. Read the stories behind the headlines in the Breaker.News. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Investigative journalist Diana Enriquez appeared in Vancouver last week at the Trace International Bribery and Economic Crime Summit. The former New York Times staff writer authored A First-Class Catastrophe, The Road to Black Monday, The Worst Day in Wall Street History, and The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust. I asked Diana about Bernie Madoff, the biggest fraudster in American history. It is estimated that Madoff bilked $65 billion from investors, and he was jailed for the rest of his life in 2009.
I actually had known Bernie before you'd ever heard of him. He had been a trailblazing innovator in the world of NASDAQ, even before there was a NASDAQ. So he started on Wall Street trading over-the-counter stocks at a time when it was a truly Wild West market. Spreads were enormous. I mean, you could, you know, a dealer like Madoff could buy at $1 a share and sell at $4 a share, and nobody would know. So the buyer who paid $4 would have no idea that he had just had those shares marked up for no vivid reason. But Bernie saw the advent of technology as a way to level the playing field for smaller firms like his. That because he figured that he could be the best bid in the market, or be the best offer in the market, and if only people knew that, he would get the business. So he was one of the early, couple of dozen early NASDAQ over-the-counter stock dealers who supported the idea of automating these quotations, putting them up on a computer screen so that everybody could see who they were. So really from the dawn of NASDAQ in the early 70s, right on through to payment for order flow, which is, of course, the predominant way order flow is directed in the market today. He pioneered that. He pioneered trading in American depository receipts, foreign stocks trading here. He pioneered that. He was one of the first firms to open firms of his size to open a London office. And he pioneered what's become known as the third market, that is the over-the-counter trading of New York Stock Exchange-listed stocks when the stock exchange is closed, which made him a huge lightning rod for antagonism among New York Stock Exchange firms, and especially among executives of the New York Stock Exchange itself. So Bernie had been on my news radar for a decade and a half before he was arrested. And as it happened, his attorney had handled a large number of white-collar criminals that I'd written about or helped launch investigations of. So the fact that Bernie knew that I knew the Bernie Madoff he was proud of being. I didn't just discover Bernie Madoff the crook. I had known the Bernie Madoff that he was proud of being. And I think because his lawyer knew me, he didn't stand in the way. He didn't raise impediments. So I was partially lucky. If Bernie had picked a different lawyer, might not have worked out. But I think it also helped that I had just been in the trenches for a long time, reporting on issues where Bernie had been a significant positive player. But even so, it took 18 months to persuade him to talk to me, and then another couple of months to get through the prison bureaucracy that allowed me to get in and interview him. After that, we established an email connection and letters and occasional phone calls that continued for years in the future.
Bernie Madoff was using the old-fashioned Ponzi scheme, but he was also forward-looking from a technology standpoint.
You can almost say he automated the Ponzi scheme. He did for the Ponzi scheme what he helped do for NASDAQ, for over-the-counter stock trading. He allowed his Ponzi schemes to scale up to really this bafflingly large level, $65 billion in paper wealth, with tens of thousands of investors all around the world. Our traditional Ponzi scheme, conventional wisdom, can't do that. He's got a circle of trust, and once he's exhausted that circle of trust, the people who know him, who admire him and respect him, once he's exhausted that circle, it's very hard for him to leapfrog into larger and larger markets. Bernie did that. It was, I think, truly the first global Ponzi scheme. And it was a combination of technology, as you've mentioned, but also of stature. His reputation allowed him to use the technology to reach into markets in Asia, markets in Latin America, markets all over Europe that he otherwise, in the old days would not have had a presence in. So he scaled up the Ponzi scheme and used internal technology, which I describe in my book, The Wizard of Lies, to show how his henchman, his chief accomplice, Frank DiPascali, designed software that allowed them to scale up the statement productions. Producing statements for all of these clients was an overwhelming physical task. But DiPascali found a way for Madoff to computerize that and scale that up. So, yes, you're right. In a way, he married the modern technology that's transforming our marketplace with a very old crime. Ponzi schemes go back before Charles Ponzi himself. They go back into the 1800s. As I'll say later today, they were originally called Peter to Paul schemes because you rob Peter to pay Paul. And you can find examples of them in the newspaper archives going back to at least the 1880s and probably earlier than that. So it's an old crime. It's a simple crime. It's just a liar with a bank account. But Bernie was able to use not only technology, but the aura of financial engineering the huge financial engineering revolution that came into the markets with the use of, you know, over-the-counter derivatives, not listed futures or listed options, but over-the-counter derivatives that allowed Bernie to make his claims more plausible, that he was in fact using OTC derivatives to hedge, to carry out his strategy. Whereas if he'd been required, if there had been no OTC derivatives, let's say that the original law passed, the Commodities Exchange Act, actually had been enforced by the CFTC, and you had to trade all financial derivatives on a regulated exchange, we would have seen the volume. We would have seen that there wasn't anywhere near enough listed volume in these futures contracts he was allegedly buying, or the S&P 100 options he was allegedly using, to support the amount of money he was allegedly managing. But regulators allowing that vast ocean of financial derivatives to go underground, I mean, to trade off regulated exchange on trading desks among banks around the world, it left reporters like you and me utterly incapable of even following up on a rumor if we'd gotten one. Because, the toughest job a journalist has to do is prove a negative. Proving that something didn't happen, isn't happening, never happened. Proving something did happen, proving it's still going on, those are tough, they can be very difficult, but they are nothing compared to proving that Bernie Madoff is not buying OTC options. You've got to call every trading desk in the civilized world. Hope that someone there will talk to you, violating customer confidentiality to do so, and hope that they'll tell you the truth. And then you got to call the next one and the next one. There's no easy way to prove a negative. So by pulling these derivatives into a opaque, over-the-counter marketplace, regulators removed one significant impediment to the growth of Bernie's scam.
There are always scammers out there of different magnitudes. It's like whack-a-mole trying to catch them. But since Madoff, since the Great Recession, has transparency, has accountability, has regulation improved?
In some venues, yes. There are some aspects of reform that came out of the Madoff case that I think have been salutary. And the reformation of the SEC's whistleblower office is one of those. It has institutionalized a healthier and better and more active response to whistleblowers, and given rise, in fact, to a systematic whistleblower industry where there are lawyers that specialize in escorting whistleblowers to the right agency to profit from the whistleblowing that they're doing. Now, it doesn't help the image of whistleblowers much to turn them into bounty hunters, but still, it's important, and many of these frauds would never have been exposed otherwise. Whistleblowers on a Ponzi scheme are less common, but there was one, Tom Petter's Ponzi scheme out of Minneapolis was exposed by a whistleblower who went quietly to prosecutors and wore a wire and taped her co-conspirators. So enhancing whistleblower policies was one big plus that came out of the Madoff case. I wish I could say that there were more things. One of the things that flowed from the Madoff experience early on was a big increase in the SEC's budget. So that it could update its hardware and software for monitoring market movements to identify these outliers that would stick up. That didn't last. I mean, as soon as the Democrats lost control of Congress in 2010, those budgets started to shrink again, and now you've got an agency that's really running on radically inadequate resources. And defunding is better than deregulation. because everybody still thinks they're protected. The laws are still on the books. But there's nobody to enforce them. There's nobody to stay with the case and get it to court and get somebody in prison as a result of it. So it's almost as good for the crooks. You know, they don't have to fight to get any laws taken off the books because there's no one to enforce it. So the funding levels, not just for the SEC, but for all of our financial crime enforcement facilities, have been playing catch-up for nearly a decade now. And that shows you lose trained people. You lose experienced people. I mean, it had happened with the SEC for so long that on the most recent Madoff investigation, the one that was done closest to his arrest, one of the three SEC lawyers working on it was 19 months out of law school. She had never done a Ponzi investigation before in her career. So it costs you. You lose people with institutional memory. You lose people with institutional training. So that's been a vast disappointment. Another disappointment for me is we came this close, so painfully close, to enacting in Dodd-Frank's reform package, the regulatory reform package in the U.S., a requirement that investment managers use an independent third-party custodian. The ineffable Professor Jack Coffey from Columbia Law School testified before Congress. I was sitting in the audience. He had reverse-engineered hundreds of Ponzi schemes and demonstrated to the congressional panel that fully 93% of them would have been impossible if a rule had been in place requiring investment managers to use an independent custodian to hold the assets. Every mutual fund in America by law is required to do that. That's why mutual fund fraud is vanishingly small. So I thought we had that one fixed. The SEC had to settle for a compromise, which was this. If you don't use an independent third-party custodian, we have the right, the SEC, to stage surprise audits of your assets at your expense. Great. With all the staff we don't have. So, you know, it put the burden on an overburdened SEC then to front the money. Maybe you could collect it later. Although, if you find the person is running a fraud, good luck collecting the cost of doing your audit, right? So I believe that the regulatory response to the Madoff scandal was inadequate in many, many ways. And as time goes by, you know, Ponzi schemes flourish when stock markets are booming, particularly when stock markets are booming in a volatile environment. People want safety and security, and most people, contrary to the conventional wisdom, most people do not search out Ponzi schemes out of greed. The modern Ponzi schemer, like Bernie Madoff, is not offering you too-good-to-be-true returns, pie-in-the-sky returns. The smart ones, like Bernie, are offering you safety and consistency in a volatile market. So, you know, PonziTracker.com, which is a wonderful website that that collects, it's kind of a clearinghouse for all the news on Ponzi schemes that surface around the world, has been tracking this since 2008 and reverse engineered back to 2002. And based on their enumeration of Ponzi schemes, about 62, at least 5 dozen fresh Ponzi schemes surface every year. That is one every 5 days. So it is a chronic problem. It is a chronic problem so long as people trust one another. And, of course, we want people to always trust one another. You can't run a modern economy otherwise. So it remains a stubborn problem. It could have been better. The U.S. could have adopted better protections but hasn't. And I'm hoping it won't take another giant Ponzi scheme to get to the point where effective regulation is taken.
That was investigative journalist Diana Enriquez. You can find out more by going to her website, DianaBHenriquez.com. That's Diana, BHeneriquez.com.
I, Justin P.J. Trudeau.
No!
Sunny ways, my friends. Sunny ways.
Thank you.
Well, I think every sector is different. It has a need for different things. We are phasing out all the extra help we're giving to the oil and gas sector. We are phasing out all the extra help we're giving to the oil and gas sector.
I, Justin P.J. Trudeau.
No!
Sunny ways, my friends. Sunny ways.
The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week, we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a deserving person or organization that has made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Roberto Luongo, arguably the best goalie in Vancouver Canucks history. He retired last week as a Florida Panther. Luongo played 19 National Hockey League seasons, including 8 for the Canucks. He will be remembered for the Game 7 Stanley Cup loss in 2011 at Rogers Arena, but he will also be remembered for being the goalie when Canada won the Olympic gold medal in overtime at the same venue in 2010. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send us an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of June 30th, 2019. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on June 30th in 1990, East and West Germany merged their economies? Prost! Now you know. Send us your feedback, send us your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week, happy Canada Day and happy Independence Day.